CD 11.
To Los Angeles, Tuesday, October 12th, 10:31 p.m. On the flight back, Sarah Jones was overcome with confused feelings. First of all, she was profoundly distressed by the fact that George Morton's body had been recovered. In some part of her mind, she'd been hoping against hope that he would turn up alive. Then there was the question of Peter Evans. Just as she was starting to like him, starting to see a side of him that was not wimpy, but rather tough and resilient in his own bumbling way, just as she was beginning, in fact, to have the first stirrings of feelings toward the man who had saved her life, suddenly there was this new woman, Jennifer somebody, and Peter was obviously taken with her. And in addition, there was the arrival of Ted Bradley. Sarah had no illusions about Ted. She had seen him in action at innumerable Nerf gatherings, and she had even once allowed him to work his charms on her. She was a sucker for actors. But at the last moment decided he reminded her too much of her ex. What was it about actors anyway? They were so engaging, so personal in their approach, so intense in their feelings. It was hard to realize that they were just self-absorbed people who would do anything to get you to like them. At least Ted was. And how had he been injured? Bitten his own tongue? Sarah had the feeling it had to do with this Jennifer. Undoubtedly, Ted had made a pass at her. The woman was pretty enough, in a street-smart kind of way. Dark hair, toughish face, compact body, muscular but skinny. A typical speeded-up New York type, in every way Sarah's opposite. And Peter Evans was fawning over her, fawning. It was sort of disgusting. But she had to admit she was disappointed personally as well. Just as she had started to like him. She sighed. As for Bradley, he was talking to Kenner about environmental issues, showing off his extensive knowledge. And Kenner was looking at Bradley the way a python looks at a rat. "So," Kenner said, "global warming represents a threat to the world."
"Absolutely," Bradley said. "A threat to the whole world."
"What sort of threat are we talking about?"
"Crop failures, spreading deserts, new diseases, species extinction, all the glaciers melting, Kilimanjaro, sea level rise, extreme weather, tornadoes, hurricanes, El Nino events."
"That sounds extremely serious," Kenner said.
"It is," Bradley said. "It really is."
"Are you sure of your facts?"
"Of course."
"You can back your claims with references to the scientific literature."
"Well, I can't personally, but scientists can."
"Actually, scientific studies do not support your claims. For example, crop failure. If anything, increased carbon dioxide stimulates plant growth. There is some evidence that this is happening, and the most recent satellite studies show that the Sierra has shrunk since 1980. As for new diseases, not true. The rate of emergence of new diseases has not changed since 1960.
"But we'll have diseases like malaria coming back to the U.S. and Europe."
"Not according to malaria experts."
Bradley snorted and folded his hands across his chest.
"Species extinction hasn't been demonstrated either. In the 1970s, Norman Myers predicted 1 million species would be extinct by the year 2000. Paul Ehrlich predicted that 50% of all species would be extinct by the year 2000. But those were just opinions. Do you know what we call opinion in the absence of evidence? We call it prejudice. Do you know how many species there are on the planet?"
"No."
"Neither does anybody else. Estimates range from 3 million to 100 million. Quite a range, wouldn't you say? Nobody really has any idea."
"Your point being?"
"It's hard to know how many species are becoming extinct if you don't know how many there are in the first place? How could you tell if you were robbed if you didn't know how much money you had in your wallet to begin with? And 15,000 new species are described every year. By the way, do you know what the known rate of species extinction is?
No.
Because there is no known rate. Do you know how they measure numbers of species and species extinctions? Some poor bastard marks off a hectare or acre of land and then tries to count all the bugs and animals and plants inside it. Then he comes back in 10 years and counts again. But maybe the bugs have moved to an adjacent acre in the meantime. Anyway, can you imagine trying to count all the bugs in an acre of land?
It would be difficult,
to put it mildly, and very inaccurate, Kenner said, which is the point. Now, about all the glaciers melting, not true. Some are, some aren't.
Nearly all of them are.
Kenner smiled thinly.
How many glaciers are we talking about?
Dozens.
How many glaciers are there in the world, Ted?
Well, I don't know.
Guess.
Maybe, 200.
There are more than that in California. There are 160,000 glaciers in the world, Ted. About 67,000 have been inventoried, but only a few have been studied with any care. There is mass balance data extending 5 years or more for only 79 glaciers in the entire world, so how can you say they're all melting? Nobody knows whether they are or not.
Kilimanjaro is melting.
Why is that?
Global warming.
Actually, Kilimanjaro has been rapidly melting since the 1800s, long before global warming. The loss of the glacier has been a topic of scholarly concern for over 100 years. And it has always been something of a mystery because, as you know, Kilimanjaro is an equatorial volcano. So it exists in a warm region. Satellite measurements of that region show no warming trend at the altitude of the Kilimanjaro glacier. So why is it melting?
Sulking. You tell me.
Because of deforestation, Ted. The rainforest at the base of the mountain has been cut down, so the air blowing upward is no longer moist. Experts think that if the forest is replanted, the glacier will grow again.
That's bullshit.
I'll give you the journal references. Now then, sea level rise? Was that the next threat you mentioned?
Yes.
Sea level is indeed rising.
Aha!
It has been for the last 6,000 years, ever since the start of the Holocene. Sea level has been rising at the rate of 10 to 20 centimeters, that's 4 to 8 inches, every 100 years.
But it's rising faster now.
Actually not.
Satellites prove it.
Actually, they don't.
Computer models prove it's rising faster.
Computer models can't prove anything, Ted. A prediction can't ever be proof. It hasn't happened yet. The computer models have failed to accurately predict the last 10 or 15 years. But if you want to believe in them anyway, there is no arguing with faith. Now, what was next on your list? Extreme weather. Again, not true. Numerous studies show there is no increase.
Look, Ted said, you may enjoy putting me down. But the fact is, lots of people think there will be more extreme weather, including more hurricanes and tornadoes and cyclones in the future.
Yes, indeed. Lots of people think so. But scientific studies do not bear them out. That's why we do science, Ted, to see if our opinions can be verified in the real world or whether we are just having fantasies.
All these hurricanes are not fantasies.
Kenner sighed. He flipped open his laptop.
What are you doing?
One moment. Let me bring it up. Here is the actual data, Ted, Kenner said. U.S. hurricane strikes over the last 100 years are clearly not increasing. And similarly, extreme weather is not more frequent globally. The data simply do not agree with you. Now, you also mentioned El Niño events.
Yes.
As you know, El Niño is a global weather pattern that begins when ocean temperatures along the west coast of South America remain above normal for several months. Once it's triggered, El Niño lasts about a year and a half, affecting weather around the world. El Niño occurs roughly every 4 years, 23 times in the last century, and it's been occurring for thousands of years, so it long precedes any claim of global warming. But what threat does El Niño represent to the U.S., Ted? There was a major El Niño in 1998. Floods. Crops ruined. Like that. All that happened. But the net economic effect of the last El Niño was a gain of $15 billion because of a longer growing season and less use of winter heating oil. That's after deducting the $1.5 billion for flooding and excess rain in California. Still a net benefit.
I'd like to see that study, Bradley said.
I'll make sure you get it. Because, of course, it also suggests that if global warming really does occur, it will probably benefit most nations of the world.
But not all.
No, Ted, not all.
So what exactly is your point? Bradley said. You're saying that we don't need to pay any attention to the environment? That we can just leave it alone? And let industry pollute and everything will be hunky-dory?
For a moment, it looked to Sarah as if Kenner would get angry. But he did not. He said, If you oppose the death penalty, does it also mean you are in favor of doing nothing at all about crime?
No, Ted said.
You can oppose the death penalty, but still favor punishing criminals.
Yes, of course.
Then I can say that global warming is not a threat, but still favor environmental controls, can't I?
But it doesn't sound like you are saying that.
Kenner sighed. Sarah was listening to this exchange, thinking Bradley wasn't really hearing what Kenner had to say. As if to prove her thoughts, Bradley continued.
Well, aren't you saying that the environment needs no protection from us? Isn't that what you are really saying?
Kenner said, no, in a way that suggested that the conversation was over. Sarah thought, Ted really is a fool. He has a severely limited understanding of what he is talking about. Ted was an actor with a script, at a loss if the conversation moved away from scripted lines. She turned away and looked toward the front of the cabin. She saw Peter talking to Jennifer, their heads together. There was a sort of intimacy in their gestures that was not instantly recognizable. She was glad when the pilot announced they were landing in Los Angeles. Van Nuys, Tuesday, October 12th, 11:22 p.m. Sanyong Tapa was waiting at the airport, looking worried. He and Kenner got immediately into a car and drove off. Sarah went home to her apartment. Bradley climbed into an SUV limo and left with an irritable wave. He was already on his cell phone. Peter Evans drove Jennifer to her car, which was back in Culver City. There was an awkward moment saying goodbye. He wanted to kiss her, but sensed some reserve and didn't. She promised she would call him in the morning. He drove home, thinking of her. Sarah did not enter his mind. It was almost midnight when Evans got back to his apartment. He was very tired and was stripping off his shirt when the phone rang. It was Janice, the exercise instructor. Where have you been, you cute thing? Traveling, he said. I have called you every single day, she said. Sometimes more, sometimes every hour. Uh-huh. What's up? My boyfriend broke up with me. I'm sorry to hear that, Evans said. Was it very... Can I come over? She said. He sighed. You know, Janice, I'm really tired. I need to talk to you. I promise I won't stay, if you don't want me to. I'm only about a block away. 5 minutes? He sighed again. Louder this time. Janice, tonight is not... Okay, good. See you in 5. Click. He sighed. He took his shirt off and tossed it in the hamper. She never listened. That was the trouble. He decided that when she got to his apartment, he would just tell her to leave. That's all. Just go. Or then again, maybe he wouldn't. Janice was uncomplicated. He was ready for an uncomplicated exchange. He pulled off his shoes and dropped them on the floor. On the other hand, he didn't want Janice around in the morning if Jennifer called. Would Jennifer call? She said she would. Did Jennifer know his home number? He wasn't sure. Maybe not. He decided to take a shower. He might not hear Janice in the shower, so he unlocked the front door for her and headed for the bathroom. The hallway was dark, and he had just a fleeting glimpse of a dark shadow before something hit him on the head, very hard. Evans yelled. The pain was intense, making him gasp, and he fell to his knees. He groaned. Someone hit him again, this time in the ear, and he fell over on his side. Disoriented, he found himself staring at a pair of feet in dirty socks, and he was being dragged into the living room. He was dropped unceremoniously on the floor. There were three men moving around him. They had dark masks over their faces, like ski masks. One of them stepped on both his arms, pinning him down, flat on his back. Another one sat on his legs and said, "Don't talk. Don't move." A growly, menacing voice. Evans couldn't move anyway. He felt disoriented. He looked around for the third man. He heard sloshing water. He glimpsed what looked like a plastic baggie. "Hold him good." The third man spoke in a whisper. He crouched by Evans's shoulder, pulled up the shirt sleeve, exposing the flesh of his arm. He was wheezing softly behind the black mask. In the same whisper, he said, "You know what this is?" He held up the baggie. The water was cloudy. Evans saw what looked like a fleshy ball, and in a panic he thought, "Oh, God, they cut somebody's balls off!" But then he saw the ball moving, undulating. It was brown with white spots, about the size of a golf ball. "You know," the man said. Evans shook his head. "You will," the man whispered, and unzipped the baggie. He pushed it against the underside of Evans's arm. Evans felt wetness. The man was manipulating the baggie, squeezing the ball. Evans was trying to see, but it was hard to see exactly what was. The ball moved. It spread, extended what looked like wings. No, not wings. It was a tiny octopus. Tiny. It could not have weighed more than a few ounces, brownish with white rings. The man was squeezing the baggie, compressing it, pushing the little octopus toward the flesh of Evans's arm. And then he understood. Evans moaned and began to struggle, trying to move against his captors. But they had him firmly, and he felt the touch of the octopus, a kind of sticky sensation, like cellophane or sticky putty or something. He lifted his head in horror and saw that the man was snapping the baggie with his finger, trying to goad the octopus, which had wrapped itself against the skin of Evans's arm, and in a flash, the rings of the octopus changed from white to blue. The blue ring of death. "That means he's mad," the third man holding the baggie said. "You won't feel it." But Evans did. It was a bite from the tiny beak, a single sting, almost like the sting of a needle. Evans jerked his arm, and the man withdrew the baggie and sealed it again. He whispered, "Hold him good." He went away a moment, then came back with a kitchen rag. He wiped the underside of Evans's arm, wiped the water off the floor. Still whispering, he said, "You won't feel anything for a few minutes." He walked over to the phone. "Don't try to call anybody," he said, and ripped the phone off the wall, smashing it on the floor. The men released him. They moved quickly to the door, opened it, and were gone. He coughed and got to his hands and knees. He looked at his underarm. The bite looked like a dimple in the flesh, a small pink spot just at the edge of the hairs of his armpit. nobody would ever see it. He did not feel anything except a sort of dull tingling at the spot where the bite had occurred. His mouth was dry, but that was probably from fear. His head hurt. He reached up, felt blood, realized that they had torn open some of his stitches.
Jesus.
He tried to get to his feet, but his arm gave way, and he fell down again, rolling on the floor. He was still disoriented. He stared into the lights in the ceiling. His apartment had that cottage cheese kind of ceiling. He hated that ceiling. He wanted to do something about it, but it was too expensive. Anyway, he had always thought he would be moving soon. He was still disoriented. He got onto his elbows. His mouth was very dry now. It was the effect of the poison. Some kind of a toad. No, he thought. That wasn't right. It wasn't a toad, it was... He couldn't remember. Octopus, that's right. It was a little octopus, hardly bigger than a thumbnail. Cute little thing. The Indians in the Amazon used them for poison for their arrowheads. No, he thought, that was toads. No octopus in the Amazon. Or was there? He was confused, becoming more confused. He broke into a cold sweat. Was that part of it, too? He had to get to a phone. He might only have a few minutes of consciousness left. He crawled to the nearest object, which was an easy chair. He'd had it in law school. It was pretty ratty. He had intended to get rid of it when he moved here, but he hadn't gotten around to it yet. The living room needed a chair right in this spot. He'd had it recovered in fabric his second year in law school. Pretty dirty now. Who had time to go shopping? With his mind racing, he pulled himself up until his chin was resting on the seat of the chair. He was gasping for breath. It felt as if he had climbed a mountain. He thought, why am I here? Why is my chin on the chair? Then he remembered that he was trying to climb up, to sit in it, sit in the chair. He got the elbow of his good arm up onto the seat and began to press himself up. Finally, he was able to heave his chest onto the chair, then the rest of his body. His limbs were getting numb and cold and heavier by the minute. They were becoming too heavy to move. His whole body was getting heavy. He managed to get himself almost upright in the chair. There was a phone on the table beside him, but his arm was too heavy to reach for it. He tried, but he could not reach out at all now. His fingers moved slightly, but that was all. His body was very cold and very heavy. He began to lose his balance, slowly at first, and then sliding over sideways until his chest rested on the arm of the chair and his head hung over the side. And there he stayed, unable to move. He could not lift his head. He could not move his arms. He could not even move his eyes. He stared at the fabric of the chair and the carpet on the floor, and he thought, this is the last thing I will see before I die. Part 6. Blue. Beverly Hills, Wednesday, October 13th, 1:02 a.m. How long Peter Evans stared at the carpet, he did not know. The arm of the chair pressing against his chest impeded his breathing, but it was becoming more difficult to breathe in any case. Images from his life flashed into consciousness. The basement where he played with his first computer. The blue bicycle that was stolen the same day he got it. The boxed corsage for his senior prom date. standing up in Professor Whitson's con law class, his legs shaking while old Whitson took him apart. "Peter? Hello? Peter?" And terrorized him. They were all terrorized by Whitson. And the dinner that was the final interview for his L.A. job, where he spilled soup all over his shirt and the partners pretended not to notice and... "Peter! Peter! What are you doing there? Peter, get up, Peter!" He felt hands on his shoulders, burning hot hands, and with a grunt he was hauled back into sitting position. "There, that's better." Janice peered at him, her face inches from him. "What's the matter with you? What did you take? Talk to me." But he could not talk. He could not move at all. She was wearing a leopard top and jeans and sandals. If she moved to one side, she was out of his field of view. "Peter," a puzzled tone, "I think something is really wrong. Have you been doing ecstasy? Did you have a stroke?" "You're too young for a stroke, but it could happen, I guess. Especially with your diet. I told you no more than 65 grams of fat a day. If you were a vegetarian, you would never have a stroke." "Why don't you answer me?" She touched his jaw, a questioning look on her face. Evans was feeling distinctly lightheaded because he could hardly breathe anymore. It was as if he had a 21-ton stone on his chest. Even though he was sitting up, the great stone weighed on him. He thought, "Call the hospital." "I don't know what to do, Peter," she said. "I just wanted to talk to you tonight, and now you're like this. I mean, I guess it's a bad time, but it's kind of scary, too. I have to be honest. I wish you would answer me. Can you answer me?" "Call the hospital. Maybe you'll hate me for this, but I don't know what you took that makes you this way, so I'm going to call 911 and get an ambulance. I'm really sorry, and I don't want to get you into trouble, but this is freaking me out, Peter." She went out of his field of view, but he heard her picking up the phone on the table next to his chair. He thought, "Good, hurry." She said, "Something is wrong with your phone." "Oh, Jesus." She stepped back into his field of view. "Your phone is not working. Did you know that? Use your cell phone." "Do you have your cell phone? I left mine in the car." "Go get it." "Maybe one of the other phones in your apartment is working." "You need to call your service provider, Peter. It's not safe to be without phones." "What's this? Somebody tore the phone out of the wall? Have we been having a fit of pique?" Knocking on the door, it sounded like the front door. "Hello? Anybody here? Hello, Peter?" A woman's voice. He couldn't see who it was. He heard Janice say, "Who are you? Who are you?" "I'm Janice. I'm Peter's friend. I'm Sarah. I work with Peter." "You're tall. Where is Peter?" "He's over there," Janice said. "Something's wrong with him." Evans could see none of this, because he could not move his eyes. And now he saw the first gray spots that signaled the impending loss of consciousness. It took every ounce of energy he possessed to move his chest and fill his lungs the tiniest bit. "Peter?" Sarah said. She moved into his field of view. She looked at him. "Are you paralyzed?" she said. "Yes, call the hospital. He's sweating," Sarah said. "Cold sweats." "He was that way when I found him," Janice said. She turned to Sarah. "What are you doing here anyway? How well do you know Peter?" "Did you call an ambulance?" Sarah said. "No, because my phone is in my car and I'll do it." Sarah flipped open her cell phone. It was the last thing Evans remembered. Brentwood, Wednesday, October 13th, 1:22 a.m. It was late. The house was dark all around him. Nicholas Drake was sitting at his desk in his home in Brentwood, near Santa Monica. He was precisely 2.9 miles from the beach. He had recently measured it in his car. so he felt secure there. It was a good thing, too, because Nerf had bought this house for him only 1 year before. There had been some discussion about it, because they had also bought him a townhouse in Georgetown. But Drake had pointed out that he needed a residence on the West Coast in which to entertain celebrities and important contributors. California was, after all, the most environmentally conscious state in the nation. It had been the first to pass anti-smoking laws almost 10 years before New York or any other eastern state did. And even when a federal court overturned the EPA on the issue of secondhand smoke in 1998, saying that the EPA had violated its own rules of evidence and banned a substance they had failed to prove caused any harm at all, the federal judge was from a tobacco state, obviously. Even then, California did not budge. The anti-smoking laws stayed. In fact, Santa Monica was about to ban all smoking outdoors, even at the beach. Now that was progress. It was easy here. But as for getting major funds, well, that was another matter. There were some rich people in the entertainment industry who could be counted on. But for the real money in California, the investment bankers, portfolio managers, CEOs, real estate trust finders, people with 500 million to a couple billion, serious money, well, those people weren't so easy. Those people inhabited a different California. Those people belonged to golf courses that didn't allow actors to join. The big money was in the hands of pioneers and tech entrepreneurs, and they were very smart and very tough. A lot of them knew their science. Christ, a lot of them were scientists. Which was why they presented such a challenge to Drake if he wanted that bonus for making his numbers for the year. He was staring at the screen, thinking it was time for a scotch, when a new window opened and the cursor blinked. Scorpio, L, can you talk? Speaking of dimwits, he thought. He typed, yes, I can. Drake shifted in his seat, adjusting the light over his desk so it would illuminate his face. He looked at the camera lens mounted just above his screen. The window opened up. He saw Ted Bradley sitting at his desk in his house in the San Fernando Valley. Well?
It was just as you said, Bradley said. Evans has gone over to the dark side.
And?
He was with that girl, Jennifer, who works on the lawsuit.
Jennifer Haynes?
Yeah. She's a wise-ass bitch.
Drake said nothing. He was listening to the sound of the voice. Bradley had been drinking again. He said, Ted, we've talked about this before. Not everybody likes it when you come on to them.
Yeah, they do. I mean, mostly they do.
Ted, this is not the impression we want to make.
Well, she insulted me.
All right. So Jennifer Haynes was there.
She's a stooge for big oil and coal. Gotta be.
And who else was there?
Sarah Jones.
Uh-huh. She flew up to see the body?
I don't know why she was there. She was with a guy named Kenner, a real asshole. Another know-it-all.
Describe him.
40s, dark, kind of butch. Looks military to me.
Uh-huh. Anyone else?
No.
Nobody foreign? No other people?
No, just the ones I described.
Would you say that Peter Evans knew Kenner?
Yeah, pretty well, I would say.
So it was your impression they were working together?
Yes, I would say very much together.
All right, Ted. Drake said, I like your instincts here. He watched as Bradley preened on the monitor. I think you may be on to something. Evans could prove a problem to us.
I'll say.
He's been one of our trusted attorneys. Why, he was in my office just the other day getting an assignment from me. If he's turned on us, he could do damage.
Damn turncoat, Ted said. He's another Bennett Arnold.
I want you to stick close to him for the next week or so.
My pleasure.
Hang out with him. Stay by his side. Buddy-buddy, you know.
I got you, Nick. I'll be on him like glue.
I'm sure he'll be at the opening of the conference later this morning, Drake said. And he thought, or then again, he might not make it.
Westwood, Wednesday, October 13th, 3:40 a.m. Kenner said,
I must say, it was an excellent choice. Hapalaclona fasciata, the most deadly of the three species of blue-ringed octopus. So named because when it is threatened, it changes color and produces bright blue rings on its skin. It's found everywhere in the coastal waters of Australia. The animal is very tiny. The bite is small and almost undetectable, and envenomation is often deadly. There is no anti-venom, and a bite's not likely to be quickly recognized at a hospital in Los Angeles. Really, a masterful choice.
Evans, who was lying in the emergency room at UCLA with a respirator on his face, just stared. He was still unable to speak, but he was no longer so frightened. Janice had gone home in a huff, mentioning something about teaching an early class. Sarah was sitting by his bed, rubbing his hand gently and looking beautiful. Where would they have gotten one?
I imagine they have several, Kenner said. They're delicate and don't live very long anyway. But they are captured in fairly large numbers because the Aussies are trying to make an anti-venom. You probably know the Australians lead the world in deadly poisonous animals. The most poisonous snake, the most poisonous mollusk, the most poisonous fish. All from Australia, or found there.
Evans thought, great.
But now, of course, UCLA has seen three cases. They're on it.
Yes, we are, an intern said, coming into the room. He checked Evans's IV and his respirator. He said, we have your preliminary blood work. It's a tetrodotoxin like the others. You should be up and around in about 3 more hours.
Lucky guy.
He smiled winningly at Sarah, then walked out again.
Anyway, I'm glad you're all right, Kenner said. It would have been embarrassing to lose you.
Evans thought, what is he talking about? He was increasingly able to use his eye muscles, and he glanced over at Sarah. But she just smiled.
Oh, yes, Kenner said. I need you alive, Peter. At least for a while.
Sitting in the corner of the room on his cell phone, Sanyong said, okay, we have some action.
Kenner said, is it where we thought?
Yes.
What happened?
We just got the receipt notice. They rented an aircraft last month. A C-57 transport.
Kenner said.
What does that mean?
Sarah said. Big aircraft. They probably need it to spray.
She looked puzzled. Spray? Sanyong said, it's pretty clear they're going to disseminate AOB, ammonia-oxidizing bacteria, in large quantities, and perhaps some hydrophilic nanoparticles as well.
To do what?
Control the path of a storm, Kenner said. There's some evidence that disseminated AOB at altitude can shift a hurricane or cyclone track. Hydrophilic nanoparticles potentiate the effect, at least in theory. I don't know if it's been tried on a large system.
They're going to control a hurricane?
They're going to try.
Maybe not, Sanyong said. Tokyo says some recent cellular and internet traffic suggests that the project may be canceled.
Then they don't have the initial conditions.
Looks like they don't, no.
Evans coughed.
Oh, good, Kenner said. You're coming around. He patted his arm. Just rest now, Peter. Try and sleep if you can. Because you know, today is the big day.
The big day, Sarah said.
The conference begins in about 5.5 hours, Kenner said.
He stood to go, then turned back to Evans.
I'm going to have Sanyong stay with you the rest of the night, he said. I think you'll be all right here. But they've already made one attempt on your life, and I don't want them to try another.
Sanyong smiled and sat on the chair beside the bed, a stack of magazines beside him. He opened the latest issue of Time magazine. The cover story was Climate Change, Doomsday Ahead. He also had Newsweek, Abrupt Climate Change, A New Scandal for the Administration, and The Economist, Climate Change Rears Its Ugly Head, and Paris Match, Climat, Le Nouveau Paris Américain. Sanyong smiled cheerfully. Just rest now, he said. Evans closed his eyes. Santa Monica, Wednesday, October 13th, 9 a.m. At 9 o'clock that morning, the invited attendees to the conference were milling around on the floor, not taking their seats. Evans was standing near the entrance, drinking coffee. He felt incredibly tired, but he was all right. He'd been a little shaky in the legs earlier, but that had passed. The delegates were clearly academic types, many dressed casually in a manner to suggest an outdoorsy lifestyle. Khakis and L.L. Bean shirts, hiking boots, Patagonia vests.
It looks like a lumberjack convention, doesn't it? Jennifer said, standing beside Evans. You'd never know these guys spend most of their time in front of computer monitors.
Is that true? Evans said.
A lot of them, yes.
And the hiking shoes?
She shrugged. The rugged look is in, at the moment.
At the podium, Nicholas Drake tapped the microphone.
Good morning, everyone, he said. We will begin in 10 minutes.
Then he stepped away and huddled with Henley.
Waiting for the TV cameras, Jennifer said.
They had some electrical problems this morning. Crews are still setting up.
So, of course, everything waits for television. At the entrance to the convention hall, there was a commotion and shouting. Evans looked over and saw an elderly man in a tweed coat and tie struggling with two security guards.
But I have been invited, he said. I am supposed to be here.
Sorry, sir, the guards were saying. Your name is not on the sheet.
But I tell you, I have been invited.
Oh, boy, Jennifer said, shaking her head. Who's that? That is Professor Norman Hoffman. Ever heard of him? No. Why? The ecology of thought? He's a famous sociologist, or should I say, a notorious one. Extremely critical of environmental beliefs. A bit of a mad dog. We had him over to the war room to ask him his views. That was a mistake. The guy never shuts up. He talks a mile a minute and goes off on tangents in every direction, and you can't turn him off. It's like a TV set that changes channels every few seconds, and there's no remote. No wonder they don't want him here. Oh, yes, he would cause trouble. He already is.
Over by the entrance, the old man was struggling with the security guards.
Let go of me! How dare you! I was invited by George Morton himself. He and I are personal friends. George Morton invited me!
The mention of George Morton sparked something. Evans went over to the old man. Jennifer said, You'll be sorry. He shrugged.
Excuse me, he said, coming up to the guards. I'm Mr. Morton's attorney. Can I help you?
The old man writhed in the grip of the guards.
I'm Professor Norman Hoffman, and George Morton invited me.
Up close, Evans saw that the old man was messily shaven, unkempt, his hair wild.
Why do you think I would come to this horrible convocation? For one reason only. George asked me to. He wanted my impression on it. Although I could have told him weeks ago, there is no surprises to be had here, I can assure you. It will unfold with all the stately ceremony of any cheap funeral.
Evans was thinking Jennifer had been right to warn him about this guy. He said politely, Do you have a ticket, sir?
No, I do not have a ticket. I don't need a ticket. Why don't you understand, young man? I am Professor Norman Hoffman, and I am a personal friend of George Morton's. Anyway, he said, they took my ticket.
Who did?
One of those guards.
Evans said to the guards, Did you take his ticket?
He didn't have a ticket.
Do you have a stub?
Evans said to Hoffman.
No, damn it, I do not have a stub! I do not need a stub! I do not need any of this, frankly!
I'm sorry, Professor, but...
However, I did manage to hold on to this!
He gave Evans the torn corner of a ticket. It was a genuine ticket. Where is the rest?
I told you they took it!
A guard standing to one side beckoned to Evans. Evans went over to him. The guard turned his cupped hand, revealing the rest of the ticket in his palm.
I'm sorry, sir, he said, but Mr. Drake gave specific orders this gentleman was not to be allowed in.
But he has a ticket, Evans said. Perhaps you'd like to take it up with Mr. Drake. By now, a television crew had wandered over, drawn by the commotion. Hoffman immediately played to the cameras, struggling anew.
Don't bother with Drake!
Hoffman yelled to Evans.
Drake won't let the truth into these proceedings!
He turned to the camera.
Nicholas Drake is an immoral fraud, and these proceedings are a travesty to the poor of the world. I bear witness to the dying children of Africa and Asia, breathing their last because of conferences like this. Fearmongers! Immoral fearmongers!
He struggled maniacally. His eyes were wild. There was spittle on his lips. He certainly appeared crazy. And the cameras switched off. The crews turned away, seemingly embarrassed. At once, Hoffman stopped his struggle.
Never mind, I said my piece. No one is interested as usual.
He turned to his guards.
You can let me go. I have had enough of this chicanery. I cannot bear to be here another minute. Let me go!
Evans said, let him go. The guards released Hoffman. He immediately dashed into the center of the room where a crew was now interviewing Ted Bradley. Hoffman stepped in front of Bradley and said,
This man is a pimp! He is an eco-pimp for a corrupt establishment that makes its living by spreading false fears! Don't you understand? False fears are a plague, a modern plague!
Then the guards were on Hoffman again, dragging him bodily out of the hall. He didn't struggle this time. He just went limp, his heels scraping on the ground as he was carried out. All he said was,
Be careful! I have a bad back! You hurt me and I'll sue you for assault!
They led him outside on the curb, dusted him off, released him. Have a good day, sir.
I intend to! My days are numbered!
Evans hung back with Jennifer, watching Hoffman.
I won't say I told you, Jennifer said. Just who is he, anyway? He's a professor emeritus at USC. He was one of the first people to study in a rigorous statistical fashion the media and its effect on society. He's quite interesting, but as you see, he has developed, strong opinions.
You think Morton really invited him here?
Peter, I need your help, a voice said.
Evans turned and saw Drake striding toward him.
What is it? That nut, Drake said, nodding to Hoffman, is probably going to go straight to the police and claim he was assaulted. We don't need that this morning. Go talk to him. See if you can calm him down.
Cautiously, Evans said, I don't know what I can do.
Get him to explain his nutty theories, Drake said. That'll keep him busy for hours.
But then I'll miss the conference.
We don't need you here. We need you there with the cuckoo.
There was a large crowd outside the conference center. The overflow was watching the proceedings on a big TV screen, with subtitles running underneath the speaker. Evans pushed through the gathering.
I know why you are following me,
Hoffman said when he saw Evans.
And it won't work.
Professor,
you're the bright young poser Nick Drake sent to put me off my purpose.
Not at all, sir.
Yes, you are. Don't lie to me. I don't like to be lied to.
All right, Evans said. It's true. I was sent by Drake. Hoffman stopped. He seemed startled by the honesty.
I knew it. And what did he tell you to do?
Stop you from going to the police.
All right, then, you've succeeded. Go and tell him I am not going to the police.
It looks like you are.
Oh, it looks like I am. You're one of those people who care about what it looks like.
No, sir, but you...
I don't care what it looks like. I care what it is. Do you have any idea what it is?
I am not sure I follow you.
What is your line of work?
I'm a lawyer.
I should have known. Everybody is a lawyer these days. Extrapolating the statistical growth of the legal profession, by the year 2035, every single person in the United States will be a lawyer, including newborn infants. They will be born lawyers. What do you suppose it will be like to live in such a society?
Professor, Evans said, you made some interesting comments in the hall.
Interesting? I accuse them of flagrant immorality, and you call that interesting?
I'm sorry, Evans said, trying to move the discussion toward Hoffman's views. You didn't explain why you think...
I do not think anything, young man. I know. That is the purpose of my research, to know things, not to surmise them, not to theorize, not to hypothesize, but to know from direct research in the field. It's a lost art in academia these days, young man. You are not that young. What is your name, anyway?
Peter Evans.
And you work for Drake, Mr. Evans?
No, for George Morton.
Well, why didn't you say so?
Hoffman said.
George Morton was a great, great man. Come along, Mr. Evans, and I will buy you some coffee and we can talk. Do you know what I do?
I'm afraid I don't, sir.
I study the ecology of thought,
Hoffman said,
and how it has led to a state of fear.
Santa Monica, Wednesday, October 13th, 9:33 a.m. They were sitting on a beach across the street from the conference hall, just beyond the milling crowds near the entrance. It was a busy scene, but Hoffman ignored everything around him. He spoke rapidly, with great animation, moving his hands so wildly that he often slapped Evans in the chest. But he never seemed to notice.
10 years ago, I began with fashion and slang,
he said.
The latter being, of course, a kind of verbal fashion. I wanted to know the determinants of change in fashion and speech. What I quickly found is that there are no identifiable determinants. Fashions change for arbitrary reasons, and although there are regularities, cycles, periodicities, and correlations, these are merely descriptive, not explanatory. Are you following me?
I think so, Evans said.
In any case, I realized that these periodicities and correlations could be regarded as systems in themselves, or if you will, ecosystems. I tested that hypothesis and found it heuristically valuable. Just as there is an ecology of the natural world, in the forests and mountains and oceans, so too there is an ecology of the man-made world, of mental abstractions, ideas, and thought. That is what I have studied.
I see.
Within modern culture, ideas constantly rise and fall. For a while, everybody believes something, and then, bit by bit, they stop believing it. Eventually, no one can remember the old idea, the way no one can remember the old slang. Ideas are themselves a kind of fad, you see.
I understand, Professor, but why?
Why do ideas fall out of favor, you are wondering?
Hoffman said. He was talking to himself.
The answer is simply, they do. In fashion, as in natural ecology, there are disruptions, sharp revisions of the established order. A lightning fire burns down a forest. A different species springs up in the charred acreage. Accidental, haphazard, unexpected, abrupt change. That is what the world shows us on every side, Professor. But just as ideas can change abruptly, so too can they hang on past their time. Some ideas continue to be embraced by the public long after scientists have abandoned them. Left brain, right brain is a perfect example. In the 1970s, it gains popularity from the work of Speary at Caltech, who studies a specific group of brain surgery patients. His findings have no broader meaning beyond these patients. Speary denies any broader meaning. By 1980, it is clear that the left and right brain notion is just wrong. The two sides of the brain do not work separately in a healthy person. But in the popular culture, the concept does not die for another 20 years. People talk about it, believe it, write books about it for decades after scientists have set it aside.
Yes, all very interesting.
Similarly, in environmental thought, it was widely accepted in 1960 that there is something called the balance of nature. If you just left nature alone, it would come into a self-maintaining state of balance. Lovely idea, with a long pedigree. The Greeks believed it 3,000 years ago, on the basis of nothing. Just seemed nice. However, by 1990, no scientist believes in the balance of nature anymore. The ecologists have all given it up as simply wrong, untrue, a fantasy. They speak now of dynamic disequilibrium, of multiple equilibrium states. But they now understand that nature is never in balance, never has been, never will be. On the contrary, nature is always out of balance, and that means...
Professor, Evan said, I'd like to ask you,
that means that mankind, which was formerly defined as the great disruptor of the natural order, is nothing of the sort. The whole environment is being constantly disrupted all the time anyway.
But George Morton...
Yes, yes. You wonder what I discussed with George Morton. I am coming to that. We are not off topic, because, of course, Morton wanted to know about environmental ideas, and particularly the idea of environmental crisis.
What did you tell him?
If you study the media, as my graduate students and I do, seeking to find shifts in normative conceptualization, you will discover something extremely interesting. We looked at transcripts of news programs of the major networks, NBC, ABC, CBS. We also looked at stories in the newspapers of New York, Washington, Miami, Los Angeles, and Seattle. We counted the frequency of certain concepts and terms used by the media. The results were very striking.
He paused. What did you find? Evan said, taking his cue.
There was a major shift in the fall of 1989. Before that time, the media did not make excessive use of terms such as crisis, catastrophe, cataclysm, plague, or disaster. For example, during the 1980s, the word crisis appeared in news reports about as often as the word budget. In addition, prior to 1989, adjectives such as dire, unprecedented, dreaded were not common in television reports or newspaper headlines. But then it all changed.
In what way?
These terms started to become more and more common. The word catastrophe was used 5 times more often in 1995 than it was in 1985. Its use doubled again by the year 2000. And the stories changed too. There was a heightened emphasis on fear, worry, danger, uncertainty, panic.
Why should it have changed in 1989?
Ah, a good question. Critical question. In most respects, 1989 seemed like a normal year. A Soviet sub sank in Norway, Tiananmen Square in China, the Exxon Valdez, Salman Rushdie sentenced to death, Jane Fonda, Mike Tyson, and Bruce Springsteen all got divorced. The Episcopal Church hired a female bishop. Poland allowed striking unions. Voyager went to Neptune. A San Francisco earthquake flattened highways, and Russia, the U.S., France, and England all conducted nuclear tests. A year like any other. But in fact, the rise in the use of the term crisis can be located with some precision in the autumn of 1989. And it seems suspicious that it should coincide so closely with the fall of the Berlin Wall, which happened on November 9th of that year.
Hoffman fell silent again, looking at Evans in a significant way, very pleased with himself. Evans said, I'm sorry, Professor, I don't get it.
Neither did we. At first we thought the association was spurious, but it wasn't. The Berlin Wall marks the collapse of the Soviet Empire and the end of the Cold War that had lasted for half a century in the West.
Another silence. Another pleased look. I'm sorry, Evan said finally. I was 13 years old then, and... He shrugged. I don't see where you are leading.
I am leading to the notion of social control, Peter. To the requirement of every sovereign state to exert control over the behavior of its citizens, to keep them orderly and reasonably docile, to keep them driving on the right side of the road, or the left, as the case may be, to keep them paying taxes. And of course, we know that social control is best managed through fear.
Fear? Evan said.
Exactly. For 50 years, Western nations have maintained their citizens in a state of perpetual fear. Fear of the other side. Fear of nuclear war, the communist menace, the Iron Curtain, the evil empire. And within the communist countries, the same in reverse, fear of us. Then suddenly, in the fall of 1989, it was all finished, gone, vanished, over. The fall of the Berlin Wall created a vacuum of fear. Nature abhors a vacuum. Something had to fill it.
Evans frowned. You're saying that environmental crises took the place of the Cold War?
That is what the evidence shows. Of course, now we have radical fundamentalism and post-9/11 terrorism to make us afraid, and those are certainly real reasons for fear, but that is not my point. My point is, there is always a cause for fear. The cause may change over time, but the fear is always with us. Before terrorism, we feared the toxic environment. Before that, we had the communist menace. The point is, although the specific cause of our fear may change, we are never without the fear itself. Fear pervades society in all aspects, perpetually.
He shifted on the concrete bench, turning away from the crowds.
Has it ever occurred to you how astonishing the culture of Western society really is? Industrialized nations provide their citizens with unprecedented safety, health, and comfort. Average lifespans increased 50% in the last century. Yet modern people live in abject fear. They are afraid of strangers, of disease, of crime, of the environment. They are afraid of the homes they live in, the food they eat, the technology that surrounds them. They are in a particular panic over things they can't even see. Germs, chemicals, additives, pollutants. They are timid, nervous, fretful, and depressed. And even more amazingly, they are convinced that the environment of the entire planet is being destroyed around them. Remarkable! Like the belief in witchcraft, it is an extraordinary delusion, a global fantasy worthy of the Middle Ages. Everything is going to hell, and we must all live in fear. Amazing! How has this worldview been instilled in everybody? Because although we imagine we live in different nations, France, Germany, Japan, the U.S., in fact, we inhabit exactly the same state, the state of fear. How has that been accomplished?
Evan said nothing. He knew it wasn't necessary.
Well, I shall tell you how, he said. In the old days, before your time, Peter, citizens of the West believed their nation-states were dominated by something called the military-industrial complex. Eisenhower warned Americans against it in the 1960s, and after two world wars, Europeans knew very well what it meant in their own countries. But the military-industrial complex is no longer the primary driver of society. In reality, for the last 15 years, we have been under the control of an entirely new complex, far more powerful and far more pervasive. I call it the Political Legal Media Complex, the PLM. And it is dedicated to promoting fear in the population, under the guise of promoting safety.
Safety is important.
Please! Western nations are fabulously safe. Yet people do not feel they are because of the PLM. And the PLM is powerful and stable, precisely because it unites so many institutions of society. Politicians need fears to control the population. Lawyers need dangers to litigate and make money. The media need scare stories to capture an audience. Together, these three estates are so compelling that they can go about their business even if the scare is totally groundless, if it has no basis in fact at all. For instance, consider silicone breast implants.
Evan sighed, shaking his head. Breast implants?
Yes! You will recall that breast implants were claimed to cause cancer and autoimmune diseases. Despite statistical evidence that this was not true, we saw high-profile news stories, high-profile lawsuits, high-profile political hearings. The manager, Dow Corning, was hounded out of business after paying $3.2 billion, and juries awarded huge cash payments to plaintiffs and their lawyers. 4 years later, definitive epidemiological studies showed beyond a doubt that breast implants did not cause disease. But by then, the crisis had already served its purpose, and the PLM had moved on, a ravenous machine seeking new fears, new terrors. I am telling you, this is the way modern society works, by the constant creation of fear. And there is no countervailing force. There is no system of checks and balances, no restraint on the perpetual promotion of fear after fear after fear.
Because we have freedom of speech, freedom of the press.
That is the classic PLM answer. That's how they stay in business,
Hoffman said.
But think, if it is not all right to falsely shout fire in a crowded theater, why is it all right to shout cancer in the pages of the New Yorker when that statement is not true? We spent more than $25 billion to clear up the phony power line cancer claim. So what, you say? I can see it in your face. You're thinking, we're rich, we can afford it. It's only $25 billion. But the fact is that $25 billion is more than the total GDP of the poorest 50 nations of the world combined. Half the world's population lives on $2 a day. So that $25 billion would be enough to support 34 million people for a year. Or we could have helped all the people dying of AIDS in Africa. Instead, we piss it away on a fantasy publicized by a magazine whose readers take it very seriously. Trust it. It is a stupendous waste of money. In any other world, it would be a criminal waste. One could easily imagine another Nuremberg trial, this time for the relentless squandering of Western wealth on trivialities, and complete with pictures of the dead babies in Africa and Asia that result.
He hardly paused for breath.
At the very least, we are talking about a moral outrage. Thus, we can expect our religious leaders and our great humanitarian figures to cry out against the waste and the needless deaths around the world that result. But do any religious leaders speak out? No! On the contrary, they join the chorus. They promote, what would Jesus drive? As if they have forgotten that what Jesus would drive is the false prophets and fearmongers out of the temple.
He was getting quite heated now.
We are talking about a situation that is profoundly immoral. It is disgusting, if truth be told. The PLM callously ignores the plight of the poorest and the most desperate human beings on our planet in order to keep fat politicians in office, rich news anchors on the air, and conniving lawyers in Mercedes-Benz convertibles. Oh, and university professors in Volvos. Let's not forget them.
How's that? Evan said. What does this have to do with university professors?
Well, that's another discussion.
Is there a short version? Evan said.
Not really. That's why headlines aren't news, Peter. But I will try to be succinct,
he said.
The point is this. The world has changed in the last 50 years. We now live in the knowledge society, the information society, whatever you want to call it. And it has had enormous impact on our universities. 50 years ago, if you wanted to lead what was then called the life of the mind, meaning to be an intellectual, to live by your wits, you had to work in a university. The society at large had no place for you. A few newspaper reporters, a few magazine journalists could be considered as living by their wits, but that was about it. Universities attracted those who willingly gave up worldly goods to live a cloistered intellectual life, teaching timeless values to the younger generation. Intellectual work was the exclusive province of the university. But today, whole sectors of society live the life of the mind. Our entire economy is based on intellectual work now. 36% of workers are knowledge workers. That's more than are employed in manufacturing. And when professors decide they would no longer teach young people, but leave that task to their graduate students, who knew much less than they did and spoke English poorly, then what happened? The universities were thrown into crisis. What good were they anymore? They had lost their exclusive hold on the life of the mind. They no longer taught the young. Only so many theoretical tests on the semiotics of Foucault could be published in any single year. What was to become of our universities? What relevance did they have in the modern era?
He stood up, as if energized by this question. Then abruptly, he sat down again.
What happened, he continued, is the universities transformed themselves in the 1980s. Formerly bastions of intellectual freedom in a world of babbitry, formerly the locus of sexual freedom and experimentation, they now became the most restrictive environments in modern society, because they had a new role to play. They became the creators of new fears for the PLM. Universities today are factories of fear. They invent all the new terrors and all the new social anxieties, all the new restrictive codes, words you can't say, thoughts you can't think. They produce a steady stream of new anxieties, dangers, and social terrors to be used by politicians, lawyers, and reporters. Foods that are bad for you, behaviors that are unacceptable, can't smoke, can't swear, can't screw, can't think. These institutions have been stood on their heads in a generation. It is really quite extraordinary. The modern state of fear could never exist without universities feeding it. There is no peculiar neo-Stalinist mode of thought that is required to support all this, and it can thrive only in a restrictive setting, behind closed doors, without due process. In our societies, only universities have created that, so far. The notion that these institutions are liberal is a cruel joke. They are fascist to the core, I'm telling you.
He broke off and pointed down the walkway.
Who is this fellow pushing toward us through the crowd? He looks oddly familiar.
Evan said, That's Ted Bradley, the actor.
Where have I seen him?
He plays the president on television.
Oh, yes, him.
Ted came to a halt in front of them, panting.
Peter, he said. I've been looking everywhere for you. Is your cell phone on?
No, because
Sarah has been trying to reach you. She says it's important. We have to leave town right away. And bring your passport.
Evan said, We? What does this have to do with you?
I'm coming with you, Ted said.
As they started to walk away, Hoffman clutched at Evans's sleeve, holding him back. He had a new thought.
We haven't talked about involution, he said.
Professor,
it is the next step in the development of nation-states. Indeed, it is already happening. You must see the irony. After all, $25 billion, and 10 years later, the same rich elitists who were terrified of powerline cancer are buying magnets to strap to their ankles or put on their mattresses. Imported Japanese magnets are the best, the most expensive, in order to enjoy the healthful effects of magnetic fields. The same magnetic fields, only now they can't get enough of them.
Professor, Evan said, I have to go.
Why don't these people just lie back against a TV screen, snuggle up to a kitchen appliance? All these things that terrified them before.
We'll talk later, Evan said, pulling his arm away.
They even sell magnets in the health magazines. Healthy living through magnetic fields. Insanity. No one remembers even a few years ago. George Orwell. No memory.
Who is that guy? Bradley said as they headed off. He seems a little wound up, doesn't he?
End of CD 11.